You're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller, here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell, and we're here to bring out the best in your pet. So, if you need help understanding why animals do some of the interesting things they do, give us a call now at 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. In addition to the calls this hour, we'll bring you the second of our three-week For the Love of a Dog topic series. It's based on Patricia's new book, and it helps us understand our pets' emotions. And Tricia, last week we learned about our animals and how they do experience emotions, just like we do. What are we going to learn this week?
Well, now that we've established that mammals, like our dogs, experience emotions, we're going to learn to identify our dog's emotions just by looking at them.
Sounds a bit easier than trying to ask them, I would guess.
You get more answers.
And we'll also talk with poet and author Ruth Padell about her travel memoir, reflecting on her pursuit to see the last living wild tigers. But before we get to that, we have some callers waiting online, so let's go to the phones. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hello, this is Jamie. I'm calling from Port St. Lucie, Florida.
Jamie, thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I have a seven-month-old lab border collie mix, and he seems to have a real problem nipping.
Mm.
We got him about a month, well, maybe 2 months ago from the Humane Society, and he seems to be a really smart dog. It took, you know, just 2 or 3 days to house train him, but the nipping has really gotten out of hand. It first started to be just our heels. Now he starts to run by our side and jump and bite. And he just doesn't seem to stop.
Well, you know, you have a genetic perfect storm in that you have a border collie with all that high energy and all those activity levels and that herding instinct to run around to the front and stop forward motion. And you have the mouthiness of a Labrador. And some border collies are really mouthy. I have a 16-week-old puppy who's pretty, you know, who could be very nippy himself. So I'm quite empathetic to this. One of the things to do is keeping in mind that this dog is a dog because of his retriever breeding, who is sort of particularly obsessed with putting things into his mouth, is to put things into his mouth that aren't your body parts. So when you start to go out on a walk, for example, you're walking out in the field somewhere, put a stick in his mouth right away. Get something in his mouth so that he's less likely to want to put something in it, like your arm or your leg. So that's one thing to do. The other thing to do is start right now. You haven't had him that long, so this is good. Start right away. Every time he's within 5 feet of you, moving towards you, ask him to sit. And ask him to sit with a huge sweeping motion of your arm. So you're going to put your arm out with your palm facing your face, and you're going to sweep your arm up so it comes up, so your hand comes up towards your own face so that
start low and go high.
Perfect. Thank you, Mueller. That's why they pay you the big bucks. Start low and go high. I'm going to use that. So what's going to happen is that he'll see your hand move up and he'll follow it. And as his chin goes up, he's more likely to sit. The idea is that you're going to teach him a habit, a good habit, that every time he comes towards you, he's going to sit down. And then the trick is for you to inhibit yourself from going, good boy, because then he's going to jump up again and want to nip. So you're gonna say, sit, and then you sink down to him, good boy. You keep your voice rolling and a little quieter, good boy. Put a stick in his mouth, and then go from there.
Now, how about when we come home from work? For example, we keep him in a little room with the door shut, and when we come home and open the door, he, you know, immediately runs out and jumps on us, and he starts gnawing on our arms.
And we
think it's a way of greeting us, and we, you know, try to pet him a little bit and calm him down, and then, you know, then he starts with the jumping and biting again. So is it a sign of dominance?
No, probably not. But one thing to keep in mind, when you said you try and pet him to calm him down, often petting actually hypes dogs up. I think they imagine our hands to be the equivalent of another puppy play mouthing onto him. So he's play mouthing you back. So what I would do is you come home, he comes bounding out to you, you're going to say, sit. And you've worked on the sit a lot when he's not so excited, right? You say, sit. You're going to have a treat in your pocket that you kept in your car. So you're totally ready. He comes up, you say, sit, and then you instantly put the toy in his mouth that you have in your other pockets.
Okay.
So this is a lot about being prepared.
And I have to tell you that it can be done. Patricia taught me to do this on a stage in front of several hundred people with a dog neither of us had ever met.
And Larry did just great. He did. So you have got your work cut out for you. Seven-month-old Border Collie Lab is a challenge, to say the least. But you definitely can get there.
Okay. So work on that, and thank you very much for calling.
Thank you very
much. Yeah, good luck.
Appreciate it very much. Tricia, you frequently mention that our dogs are often very bored, and we received a number of pet tips from dog owners who found interesting ways to keep their dogs entertained.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah, and maybe Jamie can use some of these ideas too. Kathy in Orange, Texas has a large Catahoula leopard dog with a strong drive for prey and demanding exercise needs. And when she asked a dog trainer how to keep her pup entertained, the trainer recommended something called a buggy whip. You use it much like you'd wave a string around a cat, go around in circles, drag the tip of the whip on the ground, or flip it in the air and have the dog jump for it. And Kathy notes that it's a good training tool, too, if you want to teach your dog self-control. She says this exercise is very fun for her dog, and she gets some pretty good exercise out of it, too. And we also heard from Jennifer in Pleasant Prairie, Wisconsin, who says that for a fun time, she'll occasionally sprinkle the lawn with dog food. And her dog loves to use their hunting instincts, and this is a fine way to keep them busy so they're not bored. So she just throws it around the lawn. So what about that buggy whip, though, first?
Well, first about the buggy, I think that's a great idea. It's a wonderful idea. Obviously, the idea is that the dog attends to the end of, you're not whipping your dog, the dog attends to the end of this long string-like thing. And you might even want to put a toy on the end of it. The one thing I would caution people about is having your dog jump a lot up towards it, which would be something really would be really easy to do in that kind of circumstance. And veterinarians tell us you need to be careful about having young dogs doing too much jumping, because they can land crooked.
Oh,
They can end up with some joint problems, maybe even some back problems. So just be cautious about using that in such a way your dog is jumping up all the time, because that might lead to trouble. But I think that's a great idea. And
the food.
The food, you know, we've talked about that a lot, and I think it's a great idea. Is you'd get a handful of food, you throw it out in the grass, and your dog's going to spend 15 minutes looking for the second to last piece, you know, because they don't know when the last piece is, right? The only caution there is be thoughtful about where you do that, because that's also a great way for your dog to pick up worms from the eggs that would live in the soil. So you want to do that at your own home, if you're sure you don't have a worm problem, you know, the kind of parasites that get in our dog's intestines and cause all kinds of troubles. So just be sure you're doing it in an area where that might not be a concern. But that's a great way to keep your dog busy.
Great.
It would slow me and Larry down if you tossed our dinners out in the grass.
A little lobster there or throwing around the lawn, I'd be right after it.
What an image. And Tricia crawling around on her hands and knees after chocolate.
And I love these pet tips. And how do people send us pet tips?
Yeah, send us more. And it's easy. Just send it to pets@wpr.org.
And if you'd like to join us, give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. And let's take another call. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Joe from Watoma, Wisconsin.
Joe, thanks a lot for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a fish question. I have a saltwater marine tank that I've set up in my house with the characters of Finding Nemo. So I have two clownfish and Dory. And Dory's the problem. Dory is a royal blue tang who likes to live inside the live rock inside the tank. And I bought Dory when she was a small fish, and now she's a bigger fish. But as she lives in those rocks, she scrapes her back and the top of her fins against the rocks. So Dory looks like a half a blue tang.
Aww.
It looks like she filleted herself.
Oh, dear.
But she continues to survive and thrive, and I'm just wondering what I can do about this behavior, because I've never seen it in the aquarium shops that the blue tangs do this, but every blue tang I put in my tank seems to find its home in these rocks and scrapes it up. Is there anything that you could offer me as help for this?
Well, just some thoughts. You know, I'm certainly not a blue tang behavior expert, although I've been lucky enough to enjoy seeing them in the wild, along with clownfish. You know, clownfish usually eat. I was wondering if there's a sort of predator-prey issue going on. And certainly some of these fish are highly territorial. I didn't think they competed for the same food, although possibly they do. I know clownfish like to feed on anemones and coral. I don't know as much about the feeding habits of blue tang. This is obviously, again, not my field of expertise, but clearly the tangs are afraid of something. They're using the rocks for protection. And so it might be that you're mixing species that shouldn't be mixed together. You might have probably not a predator-prey relationship, but very possibly a territorial issue going on. Certainly, you could consider building an area that the tangs can hide that's not so small. I mean, it just sounds like you've sort of got a remodeling issue going on here. So that's the first thing I would consider. But I would go back to the store where you bought the fish and ask them about these species getting along, especially if you've had other blue tangs in there and they're all hiding. Clearly, they're afraid of something. I don't think that's stretching it too far.
No, and I've seen them together in aquariums all over the place. It may be that you just have a particularly aggressive pair of clownfish. Who knows?
Just in a bad mood.
They're in a bad mood. But I'd go back and check. I think you're.
Yeah.
That's very good advice. And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Coming up next, Tricia says we can recognize our dog's emotions just by looking. And we'll find out about that right after this. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you are listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers you the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and find out when Patricia will be in a city near you. Information online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are also available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
I'm Larry Mueller here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Time for today's topic, and we continue our special edition topic series based on Patricia's new book called For the Love of a Dog, Understanding Emotion in You and Your Best Friend. And last week, we learned about emotion and whether our pets actually experience emotions. And this week, we're finding out how to tell what emotions our dogs are experiencing at any given moment. Tricia, is it really possible to tell how our animals are feeling simply by looking?
Well, it is, at least to a certain extent, because you really can compare, to some extent, the emotional life of people and dogs by looking at facial expressions, because facial expressions are actually part of how emotions are defined. You know, they're expressed outwardly as well as inwardly, and it turns out that dogs and humans actually have similar expressions when it comes to basic emotions like happiness, anger, and fear.
Okay, well, how do we know if our dog is happy, for example?
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to answer that by asking a question. I want everybody, Larry, I'm watching you, but I want everybody listening, if they feel like it, to just make a happy face. Just get really, Larry, just get really happy. And while you're making this happy face, what I want you to do is think about what your face is doing. You know, what's changed on your face? And if you think about it, I can't do it and talk at the same time, but if you think about it, When you're feeling really happy, your face is relaxed, and your lower jaw especially is relaxed, such that your mouth is open a little bit. And that's the same as a dog's face. A dog who seems relaxed and happy has his mouth slightly open. The whole face on both people and dogs is sort of full, and it's all the muscles are relaxed except the muscles around the eyes, and those are contracted, and you get that sort of like happy squinty look. You know, Larry's smiling at me right now, and his eyes got a little squinty, and that happens on dogs as well. Now, on the other hand, if your dog is angry, or if humans are angry, and this is fun to do yourself too, imagine being a five-year-old. Ooh, Larry did a very good five-year-old angry face. If you get an angry face like a five-year-old, the corners of your mouth go forward, and the eyebrows move down and together, and that's the same on a dog's face as well.
So those are some nice examples of the basic emotions we experience. What about fear, though? That's important to know. Can we identify it in our dogs?
We can. And I think it's probably one of the most important emotions to be able to identify on your dog's face, because it's so often the cause of behavioral problems, including aggression. So a fearful face on a person and a dog often includes the corners of the mouth, this time going retracting towards the ears. So if you're like really scared, your eyebrows go up, your upper lids go up, and the corners of your mouth go back. And if you're really scared, your mouth opens sort of this fear gape. And that's the same on a dog's face as it is on a human's. Now, that doesn't mean that the emotions of dogs and people are exactly the same. You know, emotions include internal changes and external expressions, but they also include thoughts. And you know, we all know that the structure and function of human brains is a lot different than that of dogs' brains. So, you know, they don't have the same rich tapestry of thoughts that we do. You know, we might think, uh-oh, my dog's about to roll in, you know, something stinky. And that influences your emotions. So that part is probably very different, but surely the similarities are as important as the differences.
And if you want to see some examples of how dogs express their emotions, we'll have some pictures up on our website, callingallpets.org. And please take a look. And boy, that's really fascinating, Tricia. I can't wait for our next For the Love of a Dog topic. What can our listeners expect next week?
Well, next week, we'll talk about why are we crazy, stupid, in love with our dogs?
Okay. We'll look forward to that. And now we look forward to talking to you at 1-800-462-7413. Let's see who's waiting for us now. Hello, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hello.
Hi, who are we speaking with?
My name's Kim, and I'm in Richmond, Virginia.
Kimberly, a pleasure to speak with you. What's on your mind?
Well, I have several children. I have three dogs and four cats, but I have one special child. Her name's Olivia, and she's part dachshund, part chihuahua. So we call her our chihuahua.
I love that. That's good.
But she's the funniest little thing. She has a going to the bathroom problem.
Okay, what's going on? What's not going on?
I have a beautiful, huge fenced-in backyard, and all the dogs, all three dogs, can come and go as they please out the back or side door whenever the weather's nice. And she just will not. Sometimes she won't go on her own. She'll sit, I'll go over to her, and she'll be shaking, and she'll have to go to the bathroom. But she won't go by herself out the open door. I have to pick her up and take her out and go with her.
Is she afraid of the door?
Not that I know.
She goes in and out of it other times?
Other times she goes in and out of it just fine.
Okay.
And sometimes what I have to do is she loves to go for a walk. So I'll take her for a walk on the leash down the street and around the block, and she does it. She goes to the bathroom just fine. But the only thing I can think of, and I don't know if this has anything to do with it, but sometimes the other two dogs, and she's been in our house 3 years, and the other dogs have been 2 to 3 years as well. One of the dogs likes to sniff her when she's going to the bathroom, and the other dog likes to urinate on her when she goes to the bathroom.
Yeah, I think that might have
that would bother me.
I think that's a very important observation. It sounds almost like she's getting harassed.
It does, and it looks like. And I have to tell Magnum and Rocco to get away from Olivia, leave her alone. And other times they won't bother her at all.
Well, it makes a lot of sense. I think it makes tremendous sense.
It bother me.
The last time somebody urinated on Larry.
I wouldn't be happy about it either.
Oh, dear. No, I think you're absolutely right. I think that without question would have an effect. And, you know, there's almost a kind of a bullying type of behavior that dogs can do to other dogs, just like kids in a playground, sort of Lord of the Flies, you know, with four paws. And you do see it often. So particularly the fact that your dog will go in and out of the dog door part of the time freely, but then you see her shaking, clearly needing to go, but not wanting to go out the door. I think without question that it is the other dog. So really the only solution I see is you're just going to have to do what a lot of us do anyway, frankly, which is, even though you have a dog door, you're just going to have to go out with your dog. Now, I would be careful to go out in the backyard, however, just you and the dog at hand, and keep the other two dogs inside. So most dog doors you can shut, so dogs can't go in and out of them. They have an actual door on them that you can close.
Sure.
So
yeah.
Rather, the one thing I want you to avoid, if every time you find your dog shaking at the dog door, you take him out on a neighborhood walk, that might be a smart way to learn to get you to take him out on a neighborhood walk. So I would take him out.
And,
yeah. Well, and good trainer, you know, good human, good for you. But I would take him out in the backyard. Just keep the other dogs away from him. And you might want to bring somebody in just to see if there might be other issues going on, because if that's going on, I get a little curious about what else is going on in the interaction between your three dogs.
And thank you very much for calling. And here's the number for you to call to join in, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, Larry and Patricia. I'm Erin calling from outside of Dodgeville, Wisconsin.
Erin, thank you so much for calling. What can we do for you?
I also have sort of a harassment issue going on in my household. I have four cats and two dogs. And I'm having a little bit of trouble keeping the peace between two of my cats.
Oh, dear.
One relationship in particular between two of my cats has been strained for a little while.
When you say little while, how long do you mean?
Probably about 4 years.
Yeah, it's always good to get a definition of what a little while is.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And how strained?
Well, one of my cats swats at her or chases her out of the room, one of my other cats, and it used to happen fairly infrequently. I'd say maybe once a week, but I've had to change all of my cats from a free choice diet to just getting fed twice a day.
Ooh, somebody's a little grumpy.
Yes, and the frequency of this has definitely increased.
Ooh. So there's one cat that's being targeted by another cat.
Right, and the cat that's being targeted has arthritis in her hip. So I just feel so bad for her.
Yeah, this sounds like a tough one, and I don't have an easy sort of magical solution.
Sure.
I mean, there are some behavior modification things you can try. You can try, for example, training the aggressor every time he or she sees the target cat, rather than hissing or spitting or going after that cat, to do something else, to do something that's incompatible with a problem behavior. You know, turn around, go get your fluffy toy.
Sure.
And you can do that. After 4 years, and given
it's
that you've
pretty hard.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's, you know, is worth the time. Have you thought about just keeping them separate? It's not an ideal solution, but have you thought about it?
I certainly have. I've sort of run the gamut of what my options are.
Yeah. What makes it so complicated are all the medical issues.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than, I mean, really, if you were my client, I would probably spend an hour and a half talking to you and meeting your cats before I even started telling you what I would do next.
Sure.
So the quick fix is indeed just keeping them separate, because it is really stressful. You've got a cat with arthritis who's being targeted, who's, you know, basically living in a house with another individual who wants to hurt them. And I think in some cases it is useful to be anthropomorphic. You know, cats experience fear, and it's very stressful. And we know that many medical conditions, and arthritis is no doubt one of them, can be exacerbated by stress. So,
which one do you separate?
Right. I was just wondering that. I'm worried if I separate out, you know, the target, is the aggressor going to pick somebody else to pick on?
Well, it depends on the behavior of the other two. You know, if they're cats who've always sort of stood up for themselves, very possibly not. Very often they're individuals who just have sort of a victim kind of personality.
Sure.
Or they're two individual cats, just like people who don't get along.
Yeah.
So it's possible that your cat would redirect, but not necessarily probable.
Mm-hmm.
I think the question is, can you separate them out and still maintain a high quality of life, you know, for both of them?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, is the arthritic cat, would that cat be happy in your bedroom, maybe cuddle with you, and the other cat not to come and sleep in the bedroom? So that's part of what you need to think about, and it depends on how your house is designed and the personality.
Yeah.
So, you know, you might want to think about bringing somebody in to do a certified applied animal behaviorist or a board-certified vet expert on feline behavior to come in and do a house call and get all the information that's needed and come up with a plan for you.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Good luck.
Yeah,
thank you
good
very
luck.
Much.
Sounds like a tough one.
Thanks very much for calling. Coming up next, we'll talk with an author about her quest to see the last wild tigers of Asia. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you are listening to Calling All Pets.
The Calling All Pets website offers online archives of the show, pet tips contributed by other listeners, and a complete list of guests featured on the program. Our website is callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Also, the radio store provides a selection of books and training guides featuring advice to deal with multi-dog households and leaving pets home alone. Information and ordering at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And this week, we welcome Ruth Padel to the program. Ruth is a poet and author, and her most recent book is a travel memoir. It's called Tigers in Red Weather, A Quest for the Last Wild Tigers. And she joins us today to talk about it. Ruth, thank you for being with us. What inspired you to pursue this quest for the last wild tigers?
Well, you know, as a child, I always read books about animals. My grandmother was the daughter, the granddaughter of Charles Darwin, and somehow always on all the bookshelves I knew as a little child were these books about naturalists and animals. And suddenly, you know, I'd finished another book, I'd finished a book of poems, and I thought, I need to go and see these things for real. I need to go into the jungles that have been inhabiting my dreams all my life.
Where did this journey take you?
Well, I started in South India. I went up through the Himalayas to Bhutan and Nepal, where there are tigers that go right up in the snow as far as sort of 4,000 feet. You know, they leave their footprints in the snow there. Then I went up to the far east of Russia on the Sea of Japan, where there are wonderful American zoologists doing great work in tiger conservation, kayaking. You get tigers going along the sea. You see the footprints in the sand. They eat the seals. And also into China, northeast China, and then the south of China. And then I came down through Korea. Probably Korea has lost its tigers, but there's a great cultural presence of the tiger there in the south. Of course, I only went to the south. And then I went further down through Southeast Asia, so that's Myanmar, the old name of Burma, and where things are very, very difficult politically, but wonderful scientists are still trying to conserve the tigers that are there. The Laos, where I kayak through the river of the Mekong and its little tributaries, and down through Thailand to Sumatra. That's where I sort of climbed up. That was the most scary forest of all. It was great big sort of mountains, volcanoes covered with dense equatorial forest full of poisonous snakes, but it was absolutely wonderful.
What an amazing journey. How did you react when you encountered your first wild tiger?
Well, it feels like a sort of blessing, really. You think this is the shrine, this is the center of the world. It's an extraordinary, extraordinary moment.
And I'm interested in the title of your book, Tigers in Red Weather. To what does red weather refer?
That comes from, it's a quotation from a poem by Wallace Stevens. And he's talking really about the imagination, the presence of the imagination, and the wildness of our own imagination and our dreams. It's a little poem, and he just sort of suggests that most people have dreams that are confined by their lace curtains, but outside there is a tramp in his boots, dreaming of catching tigers in red weather. I mean, it sounds a bit silly, but also I felt, well, the tigers are having a very bad time. They are in red weather.
Well, and you also point out that tigers are sacred symbols in many countries for many, many different reasons, and yet they are in trouble. Tiger poaching continues to be a major problem. Why is this happening?
Well, it's happening for two reasons. One is the tremendous poverty in a lot of these places. You know, if you don't know where the next meal is coming from, if you can't get fuel for your children, you know, you're in trouble. And a tiger, because of the wealth of increasing wealth of China now, and the tremendous appetite, horrible appetite for tiger skins and tiger bones for Chinese medicine, a tiger is a walking fortune. There you are, and you can't earn £5 in a year. And a tiger, for a tiger skin, for a dead tiger, you can get $2,000. Mm. I mean, that is a great, great pressure. And then there's also the loss of habitat. I mean, there are all the land that forest is being taken for agricultural land. So there are a lot of different sorts of pressures, but if they did enough, you know, preventative patrols against the poaching, that would help.
And you were just talking about China. I'm wondering about other countries. Do they have similar sets of problems? What are some of the factors contributing to this problem in other countries, and can they be corrected?
Tigers are a very political animal because they are such a symbol and because they're so, you know, beautiful. So, for instance, there's one province in Sumatra which has taken the tiger as its symbol. The tiger is a symbol of Vladivostok in the far east of Russia. And it's also, of course, the national animal of India. So it's very, very political. And the forest, the people in charge of the forest protection want to cover up and deny the fact that they're losing tigers. So that's one factor, and it's quite an important factor. There are also, you know, there's lots and lots of illegal logging and timber poaching, and the tigers need the forests. It's interesting, though, because you see, in a way, the tigers need the forest, but the forest needs the tiger. It was always the emblem and also the guardian of the forest. And the great rivers, the monsoon-fed rivers going right the way throughout Asia, they need the forest to stay there so that they close the banks and you don't get the slippage, these awful mud slides that we've seen catastrophically in the Philippines and in Sumatra and in China as well. So if the tiger, if these forests are protected in the name of the tiger, then the people will also be protected. But of course, we are very short-termists, we human beings.
Which of these countries would you say is making the best effort to try to guarantee a future for wild tigers?
Well, it's invidious to say, because it always comes down to individuals. In every system, there are bad people and there are good people. You know, Indonesia has wonderful wildlife laws, so does India. It's the trouble is in the implementing of the laws. Russia has a very, very good system. It has a tiger team, so that when it's called conflict tiger. So as soon as they get wind of a tiger that's threatening people or ended up in a barn or something, the tiger team goes down there, tries to assess why this animal is, you know, maybe it's lame, maybe it can't catch its normal prey. If that's the case, they will dart it, they will tranquilize it, do the medical stuff on it, and then relocate it somewhere away from the people.
Hmm. Your great-great-grandfather, Charles Darwin, once wrote that extinction is a part of evolution, and you quote that in your book. Are you saying that extinction is natural, then?
It's a question of levels of extinction. It would have been impossible for him to understand evolution and the origin of species without the extinction that had happened, because the fossils told him about the extinctions and the way that species evolved. But what we're seeing now is a really terrible rate of extinctions, which is practically at this point comparable to the dinosaurs. We're seeing major species go extinct every day, particularly in the tropical areas. And that's not just to do with global warming, that is also to do with the loss of forest. It's deforestation above everything.
And it sounds as though tigers are what many biologists call a keystone species, in that if the tiger population is healthy, then the forests are healthy, and healthy forests are important to healthy populations of people. Could you speak about that a little bit more?
Sure, yes. That's a good way of putting it. One biologist put it is that you know, in the old days in the mines, the miners had a canary. And if the canary looked as if it was suffering, they knew that there was gas down the mine. And if tigers start disappearing from a forest, that's a sign that there's something wrong with the forest, because the tigers need everything in the forest to survive. So that if you have 35 tigers in a forest, each of them need about 50 deer-shaped animals to eat a year. So that means a large population of deer. Of course, not just 35 times 50, but many more than that, so that the deer populations carry on going. They need all the vegetation, the trees, the bushes, the leaves, and so on. And the vegetation needs the other little animals, the ones that pollinate it, above all the birds, but the monkeys who pollinate it with their scat, who carry the seeds and so forth. So eventually, if you keep all the tigers in place, that means everything is healthy, down to the smallest little butterfly or woodlouse, or snake, or anything. And in turn, that means that the environment is healthy. The trees are releasing their oxygen into the air. You know, the fields are okay, and they're protected from the flooding of their monsoon rivers and so on. And also, the other thing is all these tiger forests in Asia, they protect the major water sources of the whole of Asia. And you know, we're going to need water more and more. As global warming kicks in more and more, there are going to be wars about water in the most bitter and awful way. And they need the water to keep coming.
Mm. And, you know, experts, and you say in your book that wild tigers might be extinct in just the next few years. Do you believe there's still a chance that wild tigers can be saved from extinction?
Well, the country that has the most of them is India. It's been losing them in large numbers in the last year or so because of the increased trade in tiger skins, and major criminal gangs are taking them up through China, or through Tibet into China. And that has got to be stopped both by the Chinese authorities, who do not play ball, but also by the Indian authorities. So if India could get its act together to protect the forests in a different system, in a more flexible and hands-on system, they could certainly be saved there. People are doing wonderful jobs, you know, tiger espionage against poaching and against timber poaching in Indonesia, in Sumatra, and also in Russia. Those are the three populations, India, Russia, and Sumatra, about 450 each in Russia and in Sumatra, and probably about 1,500 left in India, and that's it.
Through your book, you're trying to, I think, educate us about tigers, and that's an important way to help people understand the importance of tigers and maybe the need for saving them. Are you doing other things now since the book to help that process along?
Yes, I'm talking a lot to people in conservation programs and so on, and there's a lot in Britain about how conservation can communicate its, you know, the need for it, to make people more conservationally aware. Because in Britain, at least, what I discovered is that a lot of the people I live among, you know, articulate, educated people, really don't think very, very much yet about conservation. You know, they aren't aware of the great losses that are happening. And also, what I discovered during doing this research was that it is actually, pressure does make a difference. For instance, I talked to a guy on a palm oil plantation in Sumatra, and he was the sort of conservation spokesman, and he said, and there were tigers on this plantation who were eating the wild boar that came in for the fallen fruit. And he said, you know, as a result of managing this population of wild tigers, I have something to take to the table in these big sort of conglomerates when I go to Kuala Lumpur, all the big boys in the area of Southeast Asia and Malaysia. I can contribute something, and they are keen. Even all these oil companies, they are keen because there's pressure behind them, you know, in our populations back home, to say, you must be environmentally, conservationally clean. You must wise up.
Ruth, thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Well, it's a pleasure.
Ruth Padell is the author of Tigers in Red Weather, A Quest for the Last Wild Tiger. She spoke to us today from her home in London. Don't go away. Our animal trivia question of the week is coming up next with your chance to win a copy of Ruth Padell's book. And we'll take more of your calls. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell. You're listening to Calling All Pets.
If you missed an episode of Calling All Pets, the show is available online. Our website offers archives of the show, along with the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and learn more about a guest you heard on the program. More information available online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
This is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And before we go back to the phones, it's time for our animal trivia segment. And last week's question was, how long are baby gray whales when they are born? And Patricia, what was the correct answer?
Well, the average baby gray whale is actually about 15 to 17 feet long. So
Ouch.
We'll take 15, 16, or 17 at birth, and weighs around 1,500 pounds.
Oh, man.
Try carrying that around in your tummy, Mueller.
Oh, no, thank you.
A couple of months or a year. Their calves are usually born between December and February in the lagoons off Baja California. I can't wait to go sometime and visit.
Mm-hmm.
After they're born, they gain 70 pounds or so, 60 to 70 pounds a day by drinking their mother's milk, which is rich with fat.
Well,
num.
Now we know why Lynn Cox was a wee bit intimidated when she first met Grayson. And by the way, we want to congratulate the three lucky listeners who won last week's trivia contest. If you weren't one of those lucky listeners, that's okay, because we have another chance for you to win right now. All correct guessers to this week's question will have their names pulled together, and two winners will be selected at random to receive copies of the book by Ruth Bedell, Tigers in Red Weather, and one of them will be my copy, and I'll even sign it. Okay.
What a deal.
What a deal. Here's today's question. How many years must a tiger cub live with its mother before it's ready to live on its own? And if you think you know the answer to this week's question, call us at 1-800-462-7413. Tell us your answer. That's 1-800-462-7413. And tune in to Calling All Pets next week to find out the correct answer. For now, we're ready to take some more calls, so let's do that. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi.
Who are we speaking with?
This is Susan in Hayward, Wisconsin.
Thank you for calling, Susan.
Thanks for taking my call.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have a question about cats and neighbors.
Okay.
We have three cats in our family, and our neighbors also have three cats.
Uh-oh.
Here's the deal. We have about 4 acres here in Wisconsin. We share about two of those with our neighbor. And our cats, you know, go outside during the day, and they like to venture over the property line because cats have no respect for this sort of thing.
Right.
Our two adult females really tend to pick on the cats next door.
Uh-oh.
The cats next door tend to be much more indoor cats, so when they go outside, you know, they're very supervised, especially this little one. It turns out that our two females really tend to gang up on that little one to the point where the neighbors say she comes back in the house and hyperventilates in the bathroom. And because we share this property line that's about 2 acres, it's really, we don't know if there's some sort of barrier we can put up and what would actually work with cats.
Sure.
You know, it'd be different to fence in a dog, but cats can really get in and around just about anything.
Well, yes and no. Actually, you're absolutely right that you can't use a standard fence that would keep a dog in your yard for a cat, because
okay,
the cat's going to go right over it. You're absolutely right. But there are actually barriers that you can construct that do keep cats in.
Okay.
And the fence that works on cats is a fence that you have your regular vertical panel, but then there's a panel that forms a diagonal and sort of dips in towards the inside
leans
of the yard,
in.
Leans in such that the cat would have to basically be upside down to sort of walk over it, you know, up and over it.
Right.
And that does work with cats. So give your cats a smaller territory, put up the kind of a fence that I described away from the woods.
Mm-hmm.
There's a product. It's an electronic fence, basically. It's originally it was designed for dogs. The dogs wore a collar. There's a wire buried around the boundaries of the area that you decided the dog could go into. And if the dog got towards that area, first it would be warned with a beeping sound. And if it continued moving closer to the boundary edge, then the dog would get a shock. They have, I am told, adapted that to cats. Now, I have no personal experience with them, but obviously you need a tiny little collar. But this is very much a possibility for you, and that this could work in the woods. And it would basically keep your cats from going into the neighbor's side of the woods. So I would definitely give that a try.
That sounds like
that
a good
work.
That sounds like a good option.
Probably the most practical.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Patricia, we received an email from a vet in Boise, Idaho, and she says her daughter is fostering a 2 to 3 year old Rottweiler. Another
mm-hmm.
question for you. Seems to be very sweet, very well behaved, shows no signs of aggression, and is friendly to everyone he's met so far.
Okay.
Yvette's question is, in Rottweilers of unknown origin, training, and background, should his non-aggressive behavior be trusted? He seems to be extremely sweet-natured, but we have no experience with Rottweilers, and we are curious to know your opinion.
Oh, I'm so glad you asked. It's a really important question because it's so easy to form stereotypes about the behavior of groups, you know, whether they're sure. breeds of dogs or, and I can tell you that I know some Rottweilers who you just want to talk baby talk to all the time because they are the sweetest, dearest things in the world. So it is absolutely possible that this individual Rottweiler is as trustable and docile and wonderful as an animal as is possible. And I want to add that when you get an animal who has an unknown background, and it doesn't matter what species or what breed, this is absolutely true across the board. It's probably true with people too, if you think about it. Do understand that until you've seen an animal behave in a particular context, you don't know if what you have seen in your living room is going to relate to what you see, say, at the dog park. So, for example, you could adopt a border collie, for example, and I choose them because I have sure. a bunch. You could adopt a border collie who's absolutely wonderful with you, just wonderful with you. But you includes two adults and somebody and an elderly person. And then the first time your border collie meets a two-year-old, you discover that, ooh, not so trustable around two-year-olds. Or maybe the Labrador that you adopted, that you rescued, say, from a rescue organization, is absolutely wonderful with everybody of any age and is great with a collie next door, but runs after, barks and lunges, and nips at a little tiny white Bichon Frise. So in other words, until you've sort of gone through all the context, you're never exactly sure because the behavior in one context is not always predictive of another. So that's the one caution I would have. But I wouldn't worry about the Rottweiler part so much as I would worry about the part that the dog is unknown and you haven't seen him yet. Sort of like boyfriends, you know? You got to, you know, see. Or girlfriends. Larry's chiming in there. You know, you've got to see what they're really like when you're traveling and things go bad.
All right. And you can send us your email questions to pets@wpr.org, and we hope you do that. And if you'd like to join in, the number to call 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hello, this is Gil in Anchorage, Alaska.
Gil, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, I'm hoping you can help us with a behavior context that we're dealing with our yellow lab, Sunny.
Sure, what's going on?
Well, she's wonderful in just about every way, except when she's on lead, or if we encounter another dog that's on lead, then she becomes aggressive.
Mm.
Ski jaw season's approaching, and we're anxious to get back out on the trails, but it causes difficulty because then everybody's on lead.
Right. And I would not want to be ski-joring, which is having your dog pull you when you're on skis with a dog who is barking and lunging at another dog. Would not be pretty. I can see the problem. You know, there are some things you can do. This is a very common problem. It's probably the most common problem related to issues between dogs that we actually see in my office. And so there are some wonderful things you can do, which work a great deal of the time. I would never say everything works all of the time, but basically this is a perfect example of the value of teaching an incompatible behavior. So what I want you to do is I want you to teach your dog a new trick, and this is with no distractions around, okay? Do this when there's nothing else competing with you.
Okay.
You're going to have great treats in your hand. You're going to wait till your dog looks away from you. Which, if you have great treats and you have a lab, might take a while. But just look
right.
up, you know, look up, look away, fold your arms. And as soon as your lab turns, Sunny turns her head away, I want you to say, watch. And say it sort of like that, watch. Mm-hmm. So you have a better chance of getting her attention. Hopefully, she'll turn her head and look at you. And as she's turning her head, the timing is really helpful. If you get it right, I want you to go, good girl, good girl, and then give her the treat that you had in your hand, that you were holding behind your back.
All right.
And then do that over and over again. If she doesn't look, I want you to take that treat, I want you to move that hand around with the treat in it and put the treat right beside her nose and then lure her like a donkey following a carrot so that she's looking at your face, good girl, and then you're going to give her the treat. Then you're going to start asking her to do it when she is distracted, but not by other dogs.
Okay.
So start, asking her to watch when she sees a little chipmunk skitter across the snow, or she's distracted by something else. And if she responds correctly when, ooh, it was a little tough, you know, she was really looking at that squirrel with great interest, and you said watch, and gosh darn it, she turned around all on her own, I want you to jackpot her. 10 treats in a row. Good girl, good girl, good girl, good girl. So that's step two. Mm-hmm. Step three is you're going to set this up and ask her to look at your face when she sees another dog. But you have to set it up. Don't wait for this to happen. Have friends be far away with the dog on leash. You're in the other direction with her on leash. And over and over and over again, maybe 10 times in a row, as she looks at the dog, you say, watch, give her a treat. And then she'll turn her head right back to the dog, and you say, watch again. So it's fine that she keeps looking back, because that's just another chance to reinforce her for turning when you say watch. But here's the last stage, and this is the most important one, is at some point during these repetitions, she's going to see another dog, and she's going to go, I know he's going to say watch now. I'm not going to wait for that. I want that treat. So I'm going to turn and look at him without hearing anything.
Mm-hmm.
Jackpot. Good girl, good girl, good girl. 10 treats in a row, because that's what you're aiming for. The dog becomes the cue. In other words, rather than turning her head because you said watch, you're going to teach her, if I see another dog, that's the cue, that's the signal for me to turn and look at him. And now she's not barking, she's not lunging, and you're both going, oh boy, here comes a dog, because then I get to give her a treat, and she's going, I get something good. So work on that and gradually have that other dog get closer and closer.
Mm-hmm.
Make sense?
Good luck.
All right. Well, thank you.
Yeah, good luck. It works. It's some work, but it can be very effective.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Hey, it was a lot of fun this week.
Oh, it was. I don't know. Shall we do it again next week?
We shall. We'll try it again.
Oh, it's a deal.
Patricia McConnell is a PhD, certified applied animal behaviorist, and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And she's here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Calling All Pets is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0825P. More pet tips and advice for training new dogs or leaving pets home alone are available online at callingallpets.org. Our website also features a complete list of past guests and online archives of the program. The website, once again, is callingallpets.org.
On the next Calling All Pets, we'll conclude our For the Love of a Dog topic series and find out why we are so in love with our dogs.
And we'll also talk with best-selling author John Katz about the dog who changed his life.
Tune in for that and answers to your animal behavior questions on the very next Calling All Pets.